in fact being different from each other with respect to color, right? With respect to how they exhibit their blueness, still both of them can have the very same property of being blue, okay? And our key insight is that this mundane observation should be extended. So the thought is that many properties are far more versatile than theorists have typically taken them to be. Okay, so put this way, this is a very, very vague claim. It all depends on which properties are more versatile and in what way are they more versatile. However, vague as it may be, I'm going to try to convince you that this insight turns out to be incredibly fruitful for a very wide area, range of areas in philosophy. And in a nutshell, why is this insight useful? It's useful because there are many, many philosophically puzzling issues where we have a lot of independent evidence that suggests a certain property is versatile, but where theorists have kind of been reluctant to just go along with this evidence. And it turns out that if you're just happy to go along with this versatility, this is very philosophically illuminating. So in particular in this talk, I'll discuss some such cases. So one of them is a famous puzzle in philosophy of language called co-predication. I'll explain what that is. I'll talk about applying property versatility to the semantics of generics, sentences like potatoes are starchy. I'll talk about applying it to the metaphysics of repeatable artwork. And then in the very last slide, I'll just briefly mention some other potential applications. Okay, so let's start with co-predication. Consider the following scenarios. We have three copies of War and Peace on the shelf, and consider the sentence, three books are on the shelf. Okay, this sentence, I claim, has both a true and a false reading in this scenario. So the true reading is probably the more salient one, where we're counting sort of each of the copies as a book, but it also has a reading where we want to say there's just one book on the shelf, War and Peace, right? And you can add a bit more to the context to make that reading more salient. So for example, if I'm asked to write a book review about each of the books on the shelf, you might reassure me that the task isn't so bad because there's only one book on the shelf. Okay. A very natural hypothesis is that what explains these two readings of one is that the noun book itself has two readings, right? On one reading, it picks out a kind of physical object, the copy or the volume, which I'll call for short P-book. And on the other reading, it picks out a kind of informational object, the more abstract novel or text, which I'll call for short I-book. Okay, so the thought is in this scenario, we have three P books, but only one I book. So depending on which reading we choose, we get a different reading of the counting sentence. Okay, so that all sounds nice, but this hypothesis runs into trouble with what's called in the literature co-predication. Okay, so here's a classic example of co-predication. Consider the sentence, the red book is by Tolstoy. Okay, these sentences are actually very puzzling. And the reason they're puzzling is because it's perfectly easy to think of scenarios where they are true. But on the face of it, it looks like red can only be true of books in their P-book sense. And by Tolstoy can only be true of books in their I-book sense, but there's only one occurrence of the noun book, so it's not clear how we're getting the true reading. And in fact, co-predication is incredibly common. So here are some other examples. Consider lunch was delicious but took hours. We've all been in situations where that's true. But you might think, look, lunch either picks out some portion of food, which can be delicious but not take hours, or it picks out an event which can take hours but not be delicious. Similarly, consider the school was vandalized after expelling Bob. You might think, look, school can either pick out a building which can be vandalized but not expel anyone, or it can pick up the institution which can expel Bob but not be vandalized. And it's also worth noting that co-predication isn't restricted to this structure of a sort of singular term with two predicates. So just go back to that scenario with the three copies of War and Peace and focus on that true reading of one book is on the shelf, right? So that's also a case of co-predication because in order to count the books as one, it looks like we have to interpret book as meaning I book, and yet we're attributing to it the property of being on the shelf, which you might think is only a property of humans. Okay, so the literature on co-predication contains a bunch of different reactions to this puzzle. So famously and radically, Chomsky and several other theorists influenced by his work has argued that this problem is so intractable that it should lead us to give up on the whole project of systematic referential semantics, okay? Among those who have been less skeptical, there are a bunch of linguists and philosophers that have proposed some very complicated and revisionary syntactic and semantic mechanisms to try to handle this problem. Okay, so in our book, there are, I think, 7 chapters discussing all these alternative proposals and arguing against them, and arguing against them not only because they are very complicated, we argue that even if you're happy to accept the complexity, they ultimately don't give the right predictions. But that's not what I want to talk about today. What I want to talk about is just our own positive proposal, okay, which is the property versatility approach to co-predication. So let's take this case of co-predication. The book by Tolstoy is on the shelf. And just remember, why is this supposed to be puzzling? The puzzle stems from 2 assumptions, that P-books cannot be by Tolstoy and that I-books cannot be on shelves, okay? And the key to our approach is to claim that these assumptions are simply false, or more precisely, for each case of co-predication, at least one such assumption is going to be false. As it happens in this particular case, we happen to think they are both false. So P-books can be by Tolstoy and I-books can be on shelves. Okay. So this might seem initially surprising, perhaps especially the thought that I-books can be on shelves, but we argue it's less surprising once we remember that properties in general can be very versatile. Okay, so just like our gemstone and our scarf can both be blue, even though they are blue in very different ways, so we argue I-books and P-books can both share properties like being on the shelf or being by Tolstoy, even if they have them in very different ways. Okay, and another observation that might make this view more palatable is to note that sometimes when two objects share a property, one of them has it in virtue of the other, right? So for example, my desk at home touches the wall, and it's also true that the edge of my desk touches the wall, so my desk and the edge of my desk share this property, but arguably my desk has this property in virtue of the edge of the desk having it. Okay, so you might think that P-books can be by Tolstoy in virtue of some corresponding I-book being by Tolstoy, and similarly I-books can be on shelves in virtue of the corresponding P-book being on the shelf, okay? However, I wanna stress that this claim is not an essential part of our view, okay? All that matters for our view is that properties like being on the shelf are sufficiently versatile so that both P-books and I-books can have them. This is just one way to develop the view that might make it more attractive. Okay, so a natural next question is, when do iBooks and PBooks share properties in this way, right? So for example, when does an iBook have a property we typically associate with physical instances? Is it when one of its instances has it, or all of them, or most of them? Okay, so our answer is that there's no general answer here. It really varies from case to case. Okay, and a good analogy here is the relationship between properties of complex objects and properties of their parts, right? So there clearly is a tight relationship between the two, but it's not very general or systematic, right? So to pick one simple example, in order to be in this room, it has to be that all of my parts are in this room, but in order to touch this table, it's enough that some of my parts are touching this table. Okay, so you might say, look, okay, so metaphysically, maybe it's not so suspicious that there's no general recipe, but that still leaves a methodological question. How do we know which properties are versatile and in which way? And by and large, our methodology is to rely on particular judgments to provide a guide. It's a defeasible guide, but it's a good first pass. Okay, so here are some examples. You walk into a bookshop, you ask the shop assistant, where can I find War and Peace? The shop assistant says, War and Peace is on the top shelf. Imagine the top shelf has a row of lots of copies of War and Peace. So on the face of it, the shop assistant said something true. It looks like War and Peace here is denoting the informational book. After all, there's no salient physical copy for them to denote. So this suggests some evidence that the informational book has the property of being on the top shelf. Next, consider the Leningrad Codex is informative. So in case you don't know, the Leningrad Codex is the oldest surviving manuscript of the Hebrew Bible. And so it definitely seems like it refers to a P book, right? It's a particular manuscript, and it seems true that it's informative. So this suggests this P book has the property of being informative. And one source of data that's especially helpful is counting sentences, for reasons we've seen before, right? The reason is that counting sentences help us hone in on a particular reading of nouns. So again, go back to that case where we had the three copies of War and Peace on the shelf, right? The fact that we were counting the books as one suggested we were talking about an iBook. And since the sentence is true, this suggests that the iBook has the property of being on the shelf. And one very interesting thing about this counting data is that it also shows that the iBook doesn't inherit all of the properties from its physical instances. Okay, so suppose I carelessly spill coffee over all of my copies of War and Peace. It seems much worse in this context to say that exactly one book on the shelf is coffee stained, right? We only seem to get the reading where three books are coffee. Okay, so that concludes my very brief introduction to the approach. So again, in the book, we defend the approach both by arguing against alternative approaches and by lots of independent arguments. I won't have time to do all that, but let me just make a few quick remarks in defense of this view. So the first quick remark is that this should really be the default view, right? Property versatility just says these sentences have exactly the structure they seem to have. There's nothing funny going on. Of course, if we can explain a phenomena without positing any special mechanisms, then all the better, okay? Saying that this is the straightforward default view doesn't mean that there aren't difficult questions about how to analyze specific examples, okay? So to pick just one issue, look at the following sentence. The book, which is copy stained, is by Tolstoy. We can imagine cases where that's true. But in cases where that's true, there are at least two hypotheses about what's going on, right? We might think that book here means P book, and by Tolstoy is a versatile property that's true of P book. Or we might think that book here means iBook, and coffee stain is a versatile property that applies to iBook. Okay? And interestingly, that counting data we saw in the previous slide suggests that in this case, we should opt for the first option, right? Because it doesn't look like coffee stain is versatile in the right. Okay, so that's just one source of complication. And then another thing to note is that co-predication sentences are sentences of natural language. They can exhibit all the complexities of any sentence of natural language, right? They can involve context sensitivity and ambiguity and metaphorical speech and all of that, right? So for all the reasons that analyzing any sentence is hard, we'll get some difficult cases here too. Okay, second quick remark is this view actually is not at all very radical about the metaphysics of properties. Okay, so I think it's easiest to see that if you imagine a very liberal view of properties. So if you have, suppose you think for every intention, we have a property corresponding to that. So there'll be one property that corresponds to an intention that's only ever true of physical books when they're on the shelf. Okay, and there'll be another more versatile property with a wider intention that's true both of physical books and of some informational books, right? And in a way, you can think of our view as simply a view about what the term on the shelf in English means, right? It picks out this more versatile rather than this narrower property, okay? And I think actually this point can be extended even if you're not a liberal about properties, but we can talk about that in discussion. Okay, final quick remark. You might have sort of more theoretical objections to the view. So here's one kind of theoretical objection some people have raised. You might want to endorse some general principles like only material objects can have locations, or at least locations like shelves. You might also think, well, no informational object is a material object. Okay, so if you accept both of these principles, it follows that no informational book can be on the shelf. Okay, the question though, of course, is why should we accept these two principles? And one way you might try to press them is to think that the principles are somehow analytic, right? Maybe what we mean by material is something, we just define material so that having a location is sufficient to being material. Or maybe we define material so that only paradigmatic everyday objects like tables and chairs count as material. And you might think informational books certainly don't satisfy that. Okay, so material is a bit of a term of art. You can define it any way you want, but the problem is that for the objection to go through, material has to be used in the same sense in both the premises. And I think what you cannot just stipulate is that there is a single sense of material where both of these turn out to be true. Okay, so in short, we think the response to this objection is one of these principles. However you're using material, one of these principles at least is going to be false. Okay, so that concludes my discussion of co-predication. Now I wanna move on to generics. So generics are sentences like the following. Potatoes were first cultivated in South America and potatoes are starchy, okay? The very, very common view is that while 16 and 17 both count as generics, they are generics of very, very different types. Okay, so the thought is something like this. Being first cultivated in South America is a property of kinds. And correspondingly, what's going on in 16 is that potatoes refers to a kind in its Latin name, Solanum tuberosum. And we're just predicating this property of kinds to this kind. By contrast, the thought goes, Being starchy is a property of individual potatoes, not of kinds, okay? So correspondingly, in analyzing 17, we somehow have to get some structure where the predicate is predicated on over individual potatoes. Maybe there's some tacit quantification over individual potatoes. And we'll see a bit more of the details soon, but the thought is that this is achieved by postulating some kind of tacit element in the syntax of 17, which we'll call gen. Okay, so there are lots of different views in the literature on what this element gen is, but broadly they are split into two camps. So one of them is gen quantifier views, which take gen to be a quantifier. So it's either a quantificational determiner like most or every, or an adverb of quantification like usually or generally. Okay, so if we take the first option, the thought is that 17 basically has a similar structure to every potato is starchy, except instead of every, we're using this silent quantifier gen. Okay, the other camp is the gen modifier views. So the gen modifier views say, look, potatoes in 17, just like in 16, refers to the kind. We're not predicating of the kind the ordinary property of being starchy. Rather, gen is this kind of thing. It's this kind of function that takes a property of individuals and spits out a property of kinds. Okay, so the thing, what's going on in 17 is we're taking this kind solanum tuberosum, we're modifying the property of being starchy with gen, and then we're applying that modified property. Okay, so the problem is there's a problem for any view that thinks that 16 and 17 have very different structure. And we call it the problem of co-predicational generics because it's reminiscent of the problem of co-predication. The problem is that we can combine the two together, right? We can say things like potatoes, which were first cultivated in South America, are starchy, okay? And you can see these sentences are going to be a really big problem for gen quantifier views, right? On these views, it's forget about getting 18 to be true. It's not even clear how it's interpretable, right? Relative to one predicate, potatoes is supposed to denote a kind, and relative to the other, it's supposed to be some predicate bound by a quantifier. In the literature, people defending gen quantifier views have tried to use various complicated type shifting mechanisms to sort this. Their opponents have argued these mechanisms are very ad hoc and don't have much independent linguistic plausibility. Okay, by contrast, gen modifier views seem to do much better, right? So remember, they say in both sentences, potatoes just picks out the kinds. We're ascribing two properties to the kinds. It's just that being cultivated is just straightforwardly applied, while is starchy is first modified, right? So it looks like 18 has the structure where we have the kind and we apply to it first cultivated and this modified is starchy. Okay, so things seem pretty well. In fact, this is taken to be the main advantage of gen modifiers. However, not all is well for gen modifier views either. So here's one problem for these views. So the view is very well set when we have sort of one kind and two properties applied to it, but it doesn't work so well when we have one property applied once to a kind and once to an individual. So consider dogs bark, as does Emma. Right, so on these views in the first part, dogs bark, right? That's a characterizing generic. So bark here is supposed to be modified by gen and become a property of kinds. But once it's a property of kinds, we can't anaphorically apply it to the individual dog Emma. Okay, so that's one problem. Here's the second problem. So the view works quite well for simple examples, but once you look at a wider range of examples, it starts getting very messy. So consider the following generic. Mosquitoes are the most annoying widespread insect. Okay, so the problem here is that for gen modifiers view, gen somehow has to scope over annoying and over insect, because they are properties that normally are just properties of individuals, but it has to scope under widespread, right? Because that's a property of cons. Okay, so it's not so clear how we're gonna get that. One option is to maybe have two instances of gen in the structure, but it does get very linguistically complicated and also means that gen does not behave like other syntactic elements that defenders of the view have said are very similar to gen. So for example, Nickel argues that gen, like mosquitoes are annoying, our gen annoying works just like this word each in English. It's like saying mosquitoes are each annoying. But if you look at 21, that structure is not gonna work, right? We're gonna get mosquitoes are the most each annoying widespread each insects, which is ungrammatical. Okay, so that's all problems for existing views. Now I want to suggest this property versatility view of generics. So remember that the whole reason for thinking that 17 had a different structure from 16 was this thought that being starchy is a property of individuals, not cats. Okay, but how about we notice that being starchy is just a versatile property which applies both to individual and to kind. Okay, in that case, we can just interpret 17 exactly as 16. We're just applying a property straightforwardly to the kind. And on this view, we just don't need anything, any hidden structure like gen. Okay, so again, defending this view is a big task, which we devote a lot of time to. I'm just gonna mention a couple of very brief things in its defense. So the first that should be obvious by now is that this view has a very simple account of co-predicational generics, right? We just have the kind and we're just applying to it two properties, that of being first cultivated and that of being starchy. Okay. But I think even if we just look at straightforward characterizing generics, there's plenty of evidence for the view. So consider the generic dog's bark, okay? So basically our view consists of two claims. The first is that the subject term here is a kind. And I think there's lots of evidence for that. So here's one bit of evidence. Suppose I'm the manager of a zoo. In my zoo, we have 50 dingoes and 50 dogs and lots of other animals that don't bark. There's a true reading of the following sentence, right? Two animals in the zoo bark, dogs and dingoes, right? And by counting the animals as two, that kind of, again, we see the kind of force of counting sentences. We're forcing this kind of taxonomic reading where it looks like we're counting kinds, right? And this can be reinforced by this kind of calling the kinds by their Latin names. So I could also say two animals in the zoo bark, Canis familiaris and Canis lupus dingo. Okay, so this suggests that at least close variants of 20 have a reading where we're talking about kinds. Okay, the other bit of our claim is that the thing we're ascribing to the kind, barking, is just the same ordinary property that we apply to individual dogs when they bark. And we've already seen evidence for that, right? We've seen that with sentences like dogs bark, as does cats. Okay. So that's all I'm gonna say about generics. And now let me shift to a completely different area, the metaphysics of repeatable artworks. Okay, so repeatable artworks are artworks that can have multiple manifestations. So novels can have many copies and symphonies can have many performances. And there are two related questions about repeatable artworks in the literature. So the first is this category question: what kind of entities are artworks? And as Thomason puts it, this is puzzling because works of art don't fit easily into standard category systems. Works of literature are neither purely mental nor purely material. They're not, nor are they concrete physical objects or timeless, changeless, abstract. Okay, so it's puzzling what category they belong to. The other problem is this problem of mixed level property ascriptions. So the problem is repeatable artworks seem to have properties that you might expect only their manifestations to have. So here are some examples from the literature. We get these sonic properties like Aida ens pianissima. We have temporal duration properties. Hey Jude is 7 minutes, 11 seconds long. And our familiar War and Peace is on the shelf. Okay, so this kind of metaphysical puzzle of how artworks have these properties is clearly a close cousin of the puzzle of co-predication. What's pretty interesting is that there's a whole literature in linguistics and philosophy of language on co-predication, and a whole literature in metaphysics and aesthetics about the metaphysics of repeatable artwork, and there is close to zero interaction between these two bits of literature, despite the close similarity in the thing they are interested in. Okay, so going back to the category question, there are basically two camps, those that think repeatable artworks are immaterial objects. And let's look at two views of this kind. So there's the traditional type view that says repeatable artworks are types, where you can think of types as very classic sort of abstract objects. They're eye-changing, internal and necessary existing, and their manifestations are tokens of this type. Okay, so one reason people like this view is it seems to explain how a single artwork can have multiple manifestations. But one reason people have been worried about this view is that abstract objects are supposed to be eternal, and yet works of art look like they come into existence, right? When the composer composes the symphony comes into existence. Okay, so this has led others, most notably Thomason, to propose this abstract artifact view that says repeatable artworks are immaterial abstract objects, but they don't quite have the same properties as your more traditional abstract objects, and in particular, they can exist contingently and non-eternally. Okay. On the materialist side, there is a perdurantist view. I use these capital letters for the versions of the views in this debate. So there's a perdurantist view that says repeatable artworks are just fusions of their manifestations. Okay, so a symphony is a fusion of all its performances, and it's presumably going to be located in the fusion of where all its performances are. Okay, there's also an endurantist view that also thinks repeatable artworks are material objects, but ones that have slightly different relation to their manifestation, and in particular, they're wholly located where each of their manifestations is located. Okay, so starting with the immaterialist view, what do they say about this mixed level property ascription, right? These are certainly going to be a problem for the abstract type views, right? It doesn't look like abstract objects have properties like temporal durations. And even for Thomason, their view, because although she thinks they don't quite have all the properties of abstract objects, she is very explicit that they don't have properties like locations or duration. Okay, so to account for these, one view you get in the literature is this generic quantification view. I won't talk about it, I'll just mention it suffers from a lot of the problems that the gen quantifier views suffer from, but the more mainstream response is what's called this analogical predication view. And it says, the predicates here, the things like 7 minutes, 11 seconds long, In these contexts, they don't have their normal reading. They get a special interpretation, and everyone in this camp actually endorses the same proposal. The proposal is that when the property is F, we should interpret it as being having the following interpretation is such that something can't be a properly formed token of X unless it is F. Okay, so a bit of a mouthful, but in the case of 24, this will have the truth condition that something can't be a properly formed token of Hey Jude unless it's 7 minutes, 11 seconds long. Okay, so that seems pretty good as the truth conditions of 24, but there are many problems once you try more examples. So for one thing, note that this will fail disastrously for 25, right? There's a copy of War and Peace on my shelf, but it's certainly not true that something can't be a properly formed token of War and Peace without being on my shelf, right? There are plenty of properly formed token on other shelves. Okay, but even just focusing on the musical case, we have some problems. So consider this. Hey Jude and Alice's speech are both 7 minutes, 11 seconds long, right? That can be true. But of course, we have a problem because if 7 minutes, 11 seconds long is not reinterpreted, it just has the normal interpretation, then according to the view, it can't be true of Hey Jude. And if we do reinterpret it as above, it's not going to be true of Alice's speech, right? Alice's speech doesn't have any tokens. It's just one event. It doesn't have any tokens or properly formed tokens. Okay, there's another problem. Consider the sentence, Hey Jude is longer than Strawberry Fields Forever. According to the view, this is supposed to say that something can't be a properly formed token of Hey Jude unless it's longer than Strawberry Fields Forever. What's the problem with that? The problem is that Strawberry Fields Forever is itself a repeatable artwork, and according to the view, nothing can just be straightforwardly longer than it. It doesn't have a duration, right? It too, we need some kind of double reinterpretation, and there are various complications when you try to do that. Okay? Final note, a completely different way immaterialists can go is to just say, no. When we say that Hey Jude is 7 minutes, 11 seconds long, we're not reinterpreting it. 7 minutes, 11 seconds long is just a is just a versatile property that's true both of this abstract artwork and of individual performances. Okay, so I'm gonna go back to this proposal in a bit. But let's just look at what the materialist views say about these mixed level properties. Okay, so you might think materialists have a great situation here, right? The whole point of the views is like artworks are material objects, so there's no problem with them having properties like locations or durations. However, here the problem isn't that they couldn't have any durational properties. The problem is, why do they have these specific durational properties, right? So this is easiest to see with the Perdurtis view, right? If Hey Jude is supposed to be a fusion of all the performances, then it's supposed to be way, way longer than 7 minutes, 11 seconds long. Okay, and for the endurance test, there's some question of how exactly we're gonna think of its duration. So presumably following on from how Endurantism and kind of normal metaphysics are thinking of these ascriptions, just like Endurantists normally relativize properties to a time, probably here they're gonna relativize the length to a manifestation, but that still might not get you the right interpretation, right? There might be, 24 can be true even if there are no manifestations of Hey Jude or all the existing manifestations are of a non-standard length. Okay, and here too, materialists can say, so take the Perdurantists, they can say, oh, now look, when we talk of the fusion having this duration, we're not just looking at the total temporal size it's occupying. The way for a fusion to have this duration is a little bit different than for individual performances. to have the duration. Okay, so this is again essentially appealing to property versatility. So of course we're not against that, but there is a dialectical pressure for a view that says that, right? The dialectical pressure is, it's not like something like the Prodromous view was independently motivated. It's not when I asked you, what sort of thing is Hey Jude, your like immediate response was fusion of performances, right? The whole view was supposed to be motivated by its accounting for predications like this. But once we appeal to property versatility, it doesn't look like we need that motivation. Okay, so we've seen problems for both the materialist and immaterialist view. We saw that both of them can be helped by appealing to property versatility. However, I want to suggest a slightly different variant of the property versatility view. So the variant says, forget for a second about the category question. Don't start with this big picture question of what ontological category artworks belong to, but rather look at just which specific properties artworks have. So interestingly, this is exactly the methodology that Thomason professes to use. So she says, instead of starting from a ready-made ontology, I suggest we begin by paying careful attention to our literary practices so they can see what sort of things most closely correspond to them. Okay, so we think that's exactly the right methodology, except that Thomason is not applying her own methodology in the right way. Okay, so let's look at what happens when we do apply it. So again, we have this, Hey Jude is 7 minutes and 11 seconds long. Okay, so that seems to be true. We have some evidence that Hey Jude here is picking out a repeatable argument. For example, we can say things like, Hey Jude, which was performed many, many times, is 7 minutes, 11 seconds long. And we have some evidence that the predicate is just used in the same ordinary sense that we use it to predicate duration of ordinary events because of sentences like, Hey Jude is 7 minutes, 11 seconds long, as is Alice's. Okay, so if you go along with this, what does this tell us about the category question? So on its own, not much, right? Because our methodologies to just start with these pretty uncontroversial judgments. I take it we're not gonna have very uncontroversial judgments on theoretical questions like ontological category. The view might tell you something about the category questions if you add some bridge principle, right? So for example, you might accept that every object that has a location is material, and then the view will entail that Warrington's is material. Or you might accept that any object that can exist without manifestation is immaterial, and arguably you accept that Warrington's would come out as immaterial because I take it Tolstoy can sort of compose the whole book in his head and never write it out, and War and Peace would still exist. Okay, but more generally, I want to say that property versatility should leave you pretty skeptical about the interest in this category question. I think the category question is really only interesting if you think knowing which ontological category something is in is going to tell you lots of informative things about which properties it has. But on our view, this isn't going to be the case. So I think one upshot is that this category question is not going to be very interesting. Okay, so final slide. I just want to mention very, very briefly, really just in a hint, some of the other areas where property versatility turns out to be useful. So one of these is in the metaphysics of cities and countries. And here we have these puzzling sentences like France, which has an area of 550,000 square kilometers, is a republic, right? So it seems to have both these properties of like the geographical area and of a system of government. And it looks like the view can help make sense of these. In cases of collective intentionality, right? People have puzzled, how do we make sense of ascriptions like this? The band decided to play in the concert. Isn't deciding only a property of individual agents? So again, you can see how property versatility might help there. In philosophy of perception, people have puzzled about questions like this. Well, if hallucinations and veridical perceptions are objects of radically different kinds, how can they have any common properties? Well, appeal to versatile properties seems to be a sort of promising direction. And finally, in the semantics of fictional discourse, we get these kind of interesting ascriptions like Sherlock Holmes, a fictional character created by Conan Doyle, is a famous detective, right? Well, we seem to both ascribe to Sherlock Holmes properties of this kind of abstract fictional entity and sort of a real life detective. You'll note I put a question mark there because this is actually one case where we think a property versatile approach is an initially promising count, but one that doesn't ultimately work. But it's another case where it's at least fruitful to explore. Okay, so again, the details of the particular applications can be discussed or objected to, but I hope to have at least convinced you that property versatility is a very interesting and fruitful idea to explore.